Now, I was considered to be a tomboy back then, which was a more appropriate term for future lesbian. As my mom would say, it's a phase. It is a phase. She is going to grow out of those umbros. I just know it. It is a phase.
Turns out, it wasn't a phase. And Fortune Feimster is here to tell us all about it. It's The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. Today on the show, I am joined by the hilarious stand-up comedian and all-around wonderful person, Fortune Feimster. You may recognize Fortune from Last Comic Standing, Chelsea Lately, or The Mindy Project. But today marks a huge milestone in her comedy career. That's because her first ever hour-long stand-up special is now streaming on Netflix. It's called Sweet and Salty, and contains some of the most personal material she's ever performed about growing up as a, quote, tomboy in a small North Carolina town, and eventually coming out of the closet to the world and to herself when she moved to LA after college. If you like this podcast, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think. Maybe you enjoyed last week's episode with Michael Schur and just want to tell me how great it was. You can also go to ratethispodcast.com/laugh to rate this podcast wherever you listen. All right, here's me with Fortune Feimster.
I love that. That's awesome.
So, yeah, I mean, congrats. It's your first hour-long special, right?
Thank you. Yeah. I've done 2 half hours, and this was my first full hour. So I'd been, when I got asked to do the half hour for Netflix, I was prepping to hopefully do an hour. Mm-hmm. And they said, do you want to do this half hour? And I had not had my full hour set together. And you think, well, why not just take what's, you know, they're offering it to me, because it's getting harder and harder to sell an hour. Mm-hmm. So I was glad I did that. But it sort of prolonged the plan to do the hour.
Right. That was the stand-ups.
Yeah, the stand-ups.
Yeah. So on this show, we've had, I think you're the 4th out of 6 of that first season of the stand-ups that we've had. So I'm really working my way through the through the lineup. I think we have, I had Nate Bargatze, Dion Cole, Dan Soder.
Yep.
And now you.
You got to get Nikki Glaser and Beth Stelling.
Yeah, it's quite a group.
It's a good group.
Yeah, that came out in 2017.
Yeah. And then they did a season 2. But I'm really excited to have the hour, because it's the first time, I think it's the first time I've ever put out anything that's like just me.
Yeah.
You know, I've been a part of the Comedy Central half hour was a bunch of us. Mm-hmm. The Netflix thing was 6 of us. I've been on a lot of TV shows in the ensemble situation. And so this, I feel, is so personal.
Yeah, and it is very personal, mm-hmm. the special. I mean, I got to see it and I just really loved the whole hour. I think it's really great. But it is very personal material. It's sort of introducing yourself, mm-hmm. to the world in some ways and telling your personal story. So was that something that you really thought about when you set out to do it?
I did not know. I've never done a set like this before, where it's literally like, I was born and then here's my youth. Here's my high school, college. I never set out to tell a tell in that, mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. It just, I started writing these jokes, and they sort of found this weird linear timeline on its own, because I go, oh, well, that technically happened here, and then that led to this, and that led to this. And then once I had sold the hour, I was like, oh, there's a narrative, there's a story here, mm-hmm. and it sort of just morphed its way into this biography in a weird way.
Yeah, and you taped it in Charlotte, which, mm-hmm. is near your hometown, right?
Yeah, I'm from a tiny town, like 30 minutes from Charlotte, in, mm-hmm. Belmont. And because the special is so autobiographical, I mean, every story you hear is its truth. It all happened. You know, it's all the legitimate story, and there's no like fabricating for, mm-hmm. comedy. And I just thought, God, to do a set like this anywhere else would seem weird. Mm-hmm. And so I was telling these jokes in front of, you know, people who were on the swim team with me when I was 10 years old.
A lot of people from your childhood came out and to see it.
A lot of people from my childhood, a lot of family friends, a lot of people from college. So everyone, you know, knew different parts of my journey, and so they could be like, yeah, that happened. I was there.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, I saw her going through this thing, and that was kind of neat. It was a little stressful filming back home.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Which you don't really account for when you're like making this plan. Because, you know, in that area, they don't film a lot of TV. So, you know, a lot of people hadn't been to a taping before. Mm-hmm. And they were just so excited for me, which I genuinely really, really appreciate. But the, you know, in TV production, things oftentimes don't start on time.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
everything takes a little longer than you think it's going to.
Yeah. So, you know, they're there to see a live show. Like, hey, it says seven. Let's go. You know, and so it starts a little late. So everyone's, in the meantime, is drinking.
Oh, well, that helps.
In the lobby. Yeah, which is great. But by the time they get in for the show, everyone was sloshed.
Really?
And so people were just like, they were so pumped that they were like yelling out at me the entire show. Or like, you know, one woman was like sitting in the balcony, and I would tell a joke, and she'd be like, "Yep, that's right." Mm-hmm. and I kind of, you know, the first one happens, and then I tell another joke. She goes, "Yep, that happened to me too." And I finally was like, "Ma'am, I really appreciate the enthusiasm, but we're taping this."
That is hilarious. Did you have to start over and do something like clean some things up?
Yeah, I kind of had to reset myself at times. So like figuring out that timing, like you just when you set out to film a special, you just think, oh, I'm just going to do a show.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really think that you're having to like sort of self-produce while you're on stage. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting situation.
Yeah, yeah. And you had family there as well. So
yeah.
Who from your family was there? Was that stressful to do you often perform for your family?
I don't get to a lot. I don't ever mind when they're there. Mm. Because this one was funny to do in front of them because, you know, some stories involve my mom or my brothers. One of my brothers was there and his wife and my parents. And, but, you know, it's funny because you're in that work. You're at work. Mm-hmm. I'm at work.
Yeah.
And so in between shows, I'm getting notes. I'm trying to, like, you know, what worked, what didn't work. And they're just like, let's hang out. You know, remember Cousin Sue? They're like bringing the extended family down, and you know her, you know, you're just like, hi.
Okay. Yeah. So in this special, towards the beginning, you describe yourself as a tomboy, which you didn't realize at the time meant future lesbian.
Yes.
So, and that becomes a really big theme of the special is sort of you're discovering yourself and, you know, eventually coming out, which you didn't do until after college, you moved to LA. So can you just talk a little bit about, you know, setting that up in the special and why you wanted to make that, you know, a big part of it?
Yeah. Well, I think for me, the part of my journey was that I didn't come out till I was 25, 26, sometime around then. And you can look back to plenty of periods in your life where you go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Obviously I was this all along, you know, I just didn't know. And so I kind of wanted to set up that, these childhood stories that, you know, it wasn't like being gay dictated these stories or how I was. It was just, oh, that was always a part of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talk about, you know, being on the swim team and having to be a debutante at one point and clearly, you know, like fish out of water type situation. So I was sort of trying to fit who I thought maybe I'm a swimmer, maybe I'm this. You kind of try different things on until you find out what fits. And so I wanted to take people through that journey of what that childhood looks like going in and then going into college. I went to a women's college where you think, how does she not know even at a women's college that she's gay? And I'm like, well, here's how, you know, this is that environment at the time. And there was no representation. There was no, you know, seeing yourself out there in the world. And so here's me trying to fit in that world. And then I moved to LA and then I start to, this thing starts to bubble up inside of me. That's always been there, but it to the point where I can't really deny it anymore. And then my coming out story that's a part of the special is that I realize I'm gay via watching a Lifetime movie, which is the last place you think that you'll come to a huge life realization.
And on this particular day, it was not one of those murder mysteries. It was a movie called The Truth About Jane. And I don't want to bore you straighties with the plot of this movie, but basically a young girl in high school realizes that she is a lesbian, and her mom, she's like, boo! And then by the end of the movie, her mom is like, yay! And that's the movie. So I'm sitting there, and all of this like hits me like a ton of bricks. I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. And I say out loud for the first time in my entire life, I go, oh my God, I'm gay. Came to that conclusion from watching a Lifetime movie.
Yeah, the stuff about representation in pop culture I found really interesting, just because, you know, it's not that long ago, but it has, but things have changed a lot. So, so I mean, what was the pop culture landscape for like for you then compared to what you see now, and including what you've become a part of it?
Yeah, it was very different. I mean, growing up, you just didn't have the shows that we have now. Like I talk about Will and Grace, you know, things like that. YouTube, I think, alone has made the most difference with representation, because you have these gay, young gay people, the Hannah Harts of the world, you know, people that have had platforms of like showing people that they're gay, and you know, Todrick Hall, they're and so these young people are coming up with these are celebrities to them. They're huge icons to these young kids, and the fact that these people are gay, people are like, great, they're gay, who cares? And I think if I'd had a platform like that to watch when I was young, where you just see people like you, you're like, oh, I relate to what that girl's saying. I relate to these, you know, crushes that I can't really understand what it means. I think maybe I would probably have come out sooner, only because once a mirror is being held up to you, you can kind of see yourself better. So when I was coming up, I just watch, you know, the sitcoms we all watch, you know. And they usually, maybe occasionally there was like a gay man, but they didn't really talk about it, that he, you know, who his partner was. I mean, Ellen was on her sitcom.
Yeah.
And she came out and then she lost her job.
Yeah, we're talking the morning after the Golden Globes. She just got this big Carol Burnett Lifetime Achievement Award. And I found that, you know, incredibly moving, the speech by Kate McKinnon introducing her, and then talking about what the effect it had on her.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a double-edged sword with Ellen, because you saw it was representation, but you also saw the
backlash.
Yeah, what she suffered because of, you know, her braveness coming out.
Yeah, and I think Kate and I are around the same age, so we have a very similar experience in that. You know, when I remember Rosie had a talk show.
Yeah, Rosie O'Donnell.
I just remember her talking about how much she loved Tom Cruise.
You know? She wasn't really given any hints in that sense.
So it was a different time, and so then, it was a multitude of things for me. It was not only growing up in a small town where it just, you didn't really see out gay people, but it was also the lack of representation. And so once Ellen came out and Rosie came out, all these other actors, comedians came out, Wanda Sykes, you know, then you start seeing it as part of the culture. You start seeing it represented. It doesn't seem like this scary thing as much anymore. And because those people came out when they did, open those doors, some of them, you know, got backlash for it. It allowed someone like me to come a couple, you know, decade two later, I guess two decades later, and have it be a little bit easier. You know, I came out in Last Comic Standing. It was my first TV gig.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no question of, you know, well, am I going to say I'm gay or not? I was just like, this is who I am. Why would I not say it? But there was a part of me in 2010 that thought, oh my God, what, you know, if I'm coming out of the gate talking about being gay, like, is that going to hurt me?
Yeah.
But then you, as my fiance points out now, I was like, it's not like I can hide being gay. Yeah. It's very much a part of who I am.
But it is, I mean, it is a decision whether to put that in your material or not. Did you, was that part of your material in Last Comic Standing?
Yeah, but one of my first jokes that people really resonated with came from a very, another real deep, vulnerable place. And in that I would talk about how that being in the closet, I was so, you know, you get kind of intense about friendships. And my mom would say, you know, I don't understand why you get so upset when your friend Michelle goes out on a date with a guy. And I was like, because she's my best friend. And people, you know, it was the joke that people really latched onto because I was putting into words the angst that you feel as a closeted gay person when you're young, or you're just like, so every friendship with a woman was just like, why is that guy coming around to take her on a date? We're supposed to go to Chili's.
Yeah, and if you had for some reason decided to hide that part of yourself, you wouldn't have had that sort of personal, you know, comedic take on it.
Yeah, so I think it resonates with people in that, you know, we all have that thing. As you get older, you gain so much more self-awareness where you're like, oh, that's why I acted that way, you know?
Before Fortune became a comedian, she spent 7 years working the red carpet as an entertainment journalist. How that experience affected her career in unexpected ways. Up next on The Last Laugh. If you're a fan of this podcast, you are also going to love Netflix's SiriusXM show, What a Joke, with Papa and Fortune. First of all, it's hosted by my guest on today's podcast, Fortune Feimster, along with another hilarious stand-up comedian, Tom Papa. And it features great interviews with comics like Jerry Seinfeld, Ray Romano, and previous Last Laugh guests, including Jim Gaffigan, Jeff Garlin, Andrea Savage, and so many others. What a Joke with Papa and Fortune airs live 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific, Monday through Thursday on SiriusXM Channel 93. Netflix is a joke radio.
So I want to go back a little bit to before Last Comic Standing, to when you first came out to L.A.
Yeah.
So you came out to L.A. to be a personal assistant, is that right?
Yes, I did.
So how did that happen?
So I was the student speaker at my, I went to a small women's college, like I said, in Raleigh, North Carolina, and they hired a commencement speaker from LA to speak at our graduation. Emily Proctor is her name, from CSI Miami, and she was from Raleigh but living in LA and had just booked that job. And so the theater teacher at our school had gotten in touch with her. And when she came home to visit her family, she did like a acting course or something. I don't think I was there for that. And then the school, by that introduction, ended up hiring her, or not hiring, whatever, asking her to speak.
Yeah.
And because I was the student speaker, she and I had some time together and we hit it off and found we had a lot in common. And, you know, she just said this, one of those things I think people say at the end of the day, where it's like, hey, if you ever need anything, let me know.
Yeah.
And you, as a 21-year-old, I was thinking, oh, thank you. You know, I don't know what I would need from an actress in L.A., but that's really nice.
And at this point, had you been doing any theater?
I've been doing theater at the college, but I was not great at it. I had terrible stage fright.
You didn't have it in your head that you were going to be an actor in L.A. or anything?
I'd always love comedy. I grew up on SNL. I was always doing memorizing the sketches and then sort of regurgitating them to my like tennis team, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember I went to one comedy sports show and thought it was amazing. And I wanted to do improv, but I couldn't afford the classes. And at my college we were doing theater, but it was very obscure, very modern things.
Yeah.
And I'm, as you can see, not that type of actor.
You weren't feeling it.
No, I was like, when are we doing Steel Magnolias? What's with all this serious stuff?
Yeah.
And so there was never, they didn't do one comedy while I was there. And so I never, it never took with me. And so I would have been the last person anyone thought would be moving to LA or anything.
So you were doing that for a bit. And then I know you ended up as a sort of entertainment journalist, which is fascinating to me because that's what I do.
Yeah.
And so I'm very curious about your experience doing that. And I know you did red carpets, which I've had some red carpet experience.
Some nightmares.
And it's, it's the absolute worst.
Yeah.
And I don't do it anymore because of that.
Right.
But so what was your, you kind of got thrown into that, right? And didn't have a lot of experience with celebrities and all that. So what was your, how did that kind of happen? And then what was your feelings about it at the beginning?
So when I moved to work for her, I was like 23. And she was like, I don't have a ton of stuff for you to do. I basically was like a glorified like cat sitter and like grocery store food buyer and dry cleaning picker upper.
Yeah.
It's kind of your thing. She those our procedural shows, they work like 70 hours a week.
Yeah.
It's insane. So I like she was working all the time. And she basically was like, "Listen, you know, I only have so much work for you to do, so you might want to get a part-time gig." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Oh, okay." I don't know what I would do. I don't even know LA. I'm using a Thomas guide at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know where anything is. And her neighbor wrote for the LA Daily News and the New York Daily News, doing like those, you know, little like 250 word pieces on events and stuff. And she was like, "Hey, I heard because of my graduation speech," she said, "I heard that you're a really good writer. You know, Emily told me, and would you want to like cover movie premieres and things like that and award show?" I'm like, I guess, you know,
sounds
like,
pretty glamorous when you hear about it for the first time, right?
I'm 23 thinking like, I've never been to a movie premiere. Yeah. I'd like to meet Tom Hanks or whoever. And so I just kind of like was sort of randomly handed this entertainment journalism job based on a speech I wrote for my college graduation. And I started covering these events where I was doing, I mean, that's all I did was red carpets and or go to those like Hollywood parties where they're like, it's at a boutique on Sunset and you're going to interview Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
And so I did that for her for about a year. And while I was doing that, this other syndicated newspaper column was like reached out to that woman who hired me saying, "We're looking for a part-time employee. Do you have anybody?" She goes, "Well, this girl's writing for me. She's really good." I ended up writing for them. And then I sucked at being a personal assistant so bad that job came to an end. And I ended up becoming a full-time journalist for those people that had hired me part-time.
Yeah. Do you have any particularly memorable red carpet experiences that you can share?
So I ended up being a full-time entertainment journalist for 7 years. It was like my day job while I was pursuing comedy. God, I went to every event known to man. I went to Oscars, Grammys, Emmys, every movie premiere, every pre-party, all the things. I'm trying to think like. I remember I was at doing the Lord of the Ring, one of the Lord of the Rings premieres, and you know, every journalist, wow, like how many unique questions are there going to be on a red carpet?
Yeah, everyone's getting the same questions.
You got a tiny amount of time with this
if
person.
If you can even get them
if
to come over.
If you can even get that, because I did notice, I did find out very early on that with a lot of these actors and celebrities, you would see them, if there was a video, like a video camera, they would be like, "What's up?" They would be so animated. "Oh my God, this project was crazy." And then they would get to the journalist with the little recorder device.
Recorder,
and they're
like,
"Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
We had a good time." So I remember being like, the content's still going out there, you know? And
you could have started bringing your own video camera.
So I learned a lot about the relationship with the press and the celebrity and stuff, which was interesting to take in. And
yeah. Have you run into people? I mean, you must.
I have. I run into a publicist who go, oh my God, I've been following your career since your, you know, days as a journalist. Because I would say to you'd kind of get to know these publicists and I would be like, oh, I'm at the Groundlings doing improv. They're like, that's cute. Yeah. I go, yeah, but, you know, I do stand up. Okay, good for you.
They're like, okay,
yeah. Right. And now they're like, oh, my God, you did it.
Yeah. And now you, like, have a publicist. And
Yeah, I, like, just saw a guy at the Lionsgate thing who worked for, like, New Line. And he's like, hey, oh, my God, you know, it's so crazy.
What about celebrities who you
celebrities
interviewed?
Don't remember only because they interview a thousand.
I wouldn't think that they would, but it'd be funny to run into people that you once were just interviewing and had no idea who you are.
Well, like I went to Sarah Silverman's set. She had that Comedy Central show and I interviewed her and Steve Aggie, all these comics. And, you know, they would have no way to know me.
Mm-hmm.
I was just starting out at the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm.
But like I later showed her like, hey, look at this picture of us. She's like, oh my God, that's so crazy. But yeah, it was funny. Like, one of the more memorable movie premieres is that I went to the Lord of the Rings, whatever number it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, I do remember interviewing Cillian McKellen. He was amazing.
Yeah.
And I asked Lawrence Fishburne something. He was there. I don't think he was in those movies. No. His name was supporting somebody. And I asked him something and he looked at me and was like, that is the dumbest question. And I was like, kind of shocked. I was like, oh,
that hurts.
And then he walked on. And I go, oh my God, like, whoa, that was, I'm like, was it a dumb question or was he just not being nice? And so in my head, I was like, oh, maybe he's not nice. And then cut to a couple of years, maybe 2 or 3 years later, I was in the Sunday Company at the Groundlings.
Mm-hmm.
He came to see a show randomly and was so lovely. Of course he would not remember me from that tiny moment. He was so lovely, so nice in like after the show, and I could not have been lovelier. So you just never know. Like,
so he's just mean to journalists is what you're saying.
Yes, or I really just asked a really dumb question.
Or he was in a bad mood.
Yeah. So
those things are tough though.
Stuff like that's really funny.
Yeah.
MC Hammer was a difficult interview.
I can imagine.
I was just like, do you not want to be in the newspaper? Okay.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you have so many. A highlight for me was I went to the re-premiere of Mary Poppins.
Mm.
And I got to interview Julie Andrews, who I love.
Yeah.
And then I watched her and Dick Van Dyke watching themselves in the Mary Poppins movie. Yeah. That's pretty special.
That is cool. I'm curious if this experience gives you a different perspective on the media and on press compared to a lot of comedians who I've talked to on this show who are very skeptical of the media.
Really?
Very, like, you know, they're always taking things out of context. Mm-hmm. It's all clickbait. They're out to get us.
Yeah.
You know, so having had that experience and now being a comedian and with some overlap, I'm curious how that has sort of affected your thoughts about all those kinds of issues.
Well, no one really cares enough about what I'm saying for it to be clickbait.
Well, I mean, you have a Netflix special coming out, so that could change.
I could. I guess for me, having been on the other end of it, I see the mutual beneficial relationship between the two, whereas I think some actors or comedians might see it as more of like, oh, I've got to do this thing. I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And they treat, so when they come into a thing, they're kind of already not wanting to be there. They got their guard up. So maybe things are said that they're, you know, that would be come off a certain way because their attitude towards it is not on the more positive side. Having been a journalist for 7 years, I'm like, journalists need celebrities and actors and comedians and musicians as much as we need them.
Mm-hmm.
They have a job to do, and we have a job that we want to promote. Yeah. You know, it's like,
it's a transactional relationship. 100%.
So no one is more important in the transaction. You know what I mean? We're both wanting something out of it. So
I think that might be a unique perspective well, for a comedian.
Because I did it, and
you're kind of doing it still because you have the Sirius show, What a Joke with Tom Papa, and you interview comedians on that show, right?
Yeah. So that career as a journalist has come around in ways I never, ever would have imagined. I mean, for me, I was like, I'm just paying the bills, and it's a cool job to get to do while I'm trying to do the thing I really want to do, which is be a comedian. But when I got the interview for Chelsea Lately, it was as a writer first. And I remember in the interview thinking, like, I'm at such a disadvantage because I've never written on a TV show. And I was only maybe 3 years into stand-up when I got that job. And so I thought, God, there's no way they're going to hire me. I have nothing to offer them except for my raw comedy skills that I had acquired through the growlings up until that point. But then it occurred to me mid-interview, I go, oh, my God. Like it was a weird light bulb moment where I go, oh, my God, I was an entertainment journalist for 7 years.
I have been writing for seven years.
And it's all pop culture, celebrity, entertainment based. So literally any person that comes through this talk show, I will know plenty of background on them. I mean, that was my whole
job. Do you think that
helped
you get hired there?
I think ultimately what helped is that Chelsea, having learned... Knowing what I know now is she doesn't, at the time, she didn't like meetings. And the producers gave me a call back or whatever. And I think they had like maybe six people they were going to see for the meeting with Chelsea for her to whittle it down to a person that she wanted to hire. I happened to be the first interview of the day. And I think Chelsea, she likes chubby people and she likes people that are different. And I definitely was different. No one was putting me on TV at the time. I stood out, which at the time was a negative thing. I had tested twice for SNL and I just was too different for so many people. I cannot tell you how many people would be like, we like her, but we don't know what to do with her. And to Chelsea, that is a big bonus. And she stopped my interview mid-interview and goes, okay, thanks for coming. And I thought...
You thought that was it?
That was it. I'd failed. Oh, man. I'm not and I got hired. And what I know now is, thankfully, I was the first meeting and she liked me.
Yeah, so, and she can be pretty blunt in either direction.
Yeah, so. If she hadn't liked me, she just would have ended it and been like, when's the next meeting? But because she was like, oh, this will do. I don't want
to
do another meeting. And I had seen her do that with somebody else. I won't say who. On her sitcom, she didn't want to drive back over the hill to do a bunch of more auditions. She goes, just give it to so-and-so. And I go, oh, my God, that's so crazy. You know? And so I think it was part being right for the job and part luck, you know?
Yeah, so you mentioned SNL, you know, you tested there twice, and that probably came out of being at the Groundlings, right? That's sort of how you got there.
Sort of.
Yeah.
The first interview audition, I had been doing the Groundlings, and I was in advance, so it wasn't to the point where they actually, the scouts come out and see you. I never would have guessed that this would have been an end to SNL in a million years, but someone I grew up with in my tiny town of 5,000 people was sorority sisters and good friends with Lindsay Shookus, who's still a producer at SNL. And she, you know, she said to Lindsay, she goes, I have this friend who's a comedian. If she makes an audition tape, will you watch it? And Lindsay, you know, I'm sure gets that a million times. She said, sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So my friend tells me this. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Usually you have to be asked. They're not just accepting tapes from people. Yeah.
And I go, yeah, okay. She's going to watch my tape. She goes, no, she's going to watch it. Just make a tape. So I put together a tape. I think of me in like my kitchen, you know, against a white wall.
Do you remember what you did?
I think it was like Richard Simmons and Susan Boyle and then some random characters that I had created on my own. And I submitted this tape via she told me where to send it. And a couple months went by. And I didn't even think anything about it. And I had my first advance show at the Groundlings. And the next day I get a phone call from Lindsay. She goes, hey, you know, it's Lindsay from Saturday Night Live. It's that call that you dream of your whole life. And I go, what? She goes, we watched your tape. I've been wanting to call you for weeks, but I finally got the green light, and we want your audition for SNL. Catch is, you have to be on a plane tonight, the red eye, and you're going to audition tomorrow morning. And I go, what? And so everyone...
Do you think they do that just to, like, throw you?
I mean, I really don't know what that was, because...
Like, there's no, like, real good reason why they need to do it like that.
I don't know. I think what happened was she and Marcy Klein really liked my tape and really wanted me to come in, and I think Lauren was the...
He wasn't sure.
He wasn't sure. And I was pretty green, because, you know, I hadn't even gone through the Sunday Company yet. And,
this is before last Comic Standing.
Yeah, this was 2009.
You had never been on TV.
Never been on TV.
Yeah.
So I was unknown. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of people thought SNL had come to our advance show, and they didn't know it came from this
totally
crazy tape. Yeah. And so I auditioned, but in a way it was a blessing because I was so like shot out of a cannon. Yeah.
You had to come up with new stuff. Or could you do the same
thing? I did like half and half. Yeah. But that audition, I think, was better than my second audition because I didn't have time to overthink it.
Yeah.
And then...
Or the one when you flew out was better than the tape? Or
they saw the tape and then I flew out two different summers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And so that first summer's audition, I think, was a better audition. Mm. But had I auditioned 2 years later... I was a much different performer because I gained a year and a half of the Sunday Company, where it is a training ground for SNL, but I got the auditions early on.
Yeah, it's almost like, you got
it
too early.
A little bit of a blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
And then so I didn't get that first round, which is kind of common. A lot of people test two or three times, like Taron Killam, we tested together two of the times. He got it on his third one.
Mm.
So then they came that next round. They watched us all perform live and then brought us back the next summer. So I tested, I flew out a second time.
Mm-hmm.
And Marcy Klein was like, oh my God, I'm so glad Lauren got to see you perform live. He finally said he saw what the rest of us see. But my audition was just okay that second time, and ultimately I didn't get it. And then I got Chelsea like 6 months later, so I don't know if that would have continued or if that was never going to happen.
Yeah. Was it very disappointing in the moment, though, to not get it? And
for sure, because I think that for a lot of comics, that was kind of the end-all be-all was SNL. It was such a part of our childhood and... Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that point when you would get on, I mean, SNL back in the day would make people stars overnight.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same now because there's so much content out there.
More shows, more opportunities.
Yeah. And so at the time, though, I had no job. I mean, I was like still doing the entertainment journalism, but I was broke because I didn't pay well.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not been on TV. So you think in your head, like, that's my only opportunity.
Right.
This is the only shot I'm going to get. And once you get the no, they don't actually tell you no. You just
read
don't
hear
in the
anything.
Paper who got hired that season. The dream just has to shift. You just have to have a new dream.
So how did you approach that? I mean, did you kind of double down on stand-up, or did you you ended up getting the writing job? But...
That's another funny thing is I didn't even know I could do stand-up at my audition. Mm. I heard, like, you know, months, like, oh, so-and-so did stand-up at there. I go, what?
I just heard Dan Soder, who was on this show, but on another podcast, talking about that, and he did all these characters. He's a stand-up, and he goes, he was auditioning with Pete Davidson, who just did a stand-up.
Again, who knows? Like, at the time, I think my stand up would have been stronger.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know that would have been that could have been an option.
Yeah. Everyone kind of gets different information.
Yeah,
and different
signals. You get told you need to bring in three original characters and three impressions, and you only have 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So you think, I got to cram all these characters. Had I known I could do stand up, because you bring your A game the first audition.
Yeah.
The second one, they want all new stuff. You're like, I gave you my A stuff. So if I had known I could now do stand-up too, it would have been... But it wasn't... What I have to come back to is it wasn't meant to be for me.
Yeah.
It wasn't... And who knows, like, maybe I would have been miserable on the show or in New York. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, it wasn't supposed to happen.
There's also
for
a pretty
me.
Great list of people who auditioned for SNL and didn't get it. So yeah. it's good company too.
Yeah. So you just, you know, I got a lot of, I mean, I still get lots of no's. That's just part of the business, is constant no's. Mm-hmm. And so what you have to do is you sort of have to use them as motivation to find whatever where the yes is, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it forces you to get better at your thing.
Yeah.
It forced me to like hunker down at the Groundlings and become a better sketch performer, forced me to do better at stand up, so that whatever the new dream is, the new dream then becomes, okay, well, I just want to get hired. I just want a job. Mm-hmm. And you make it to the point where, okay, how can I make myself better to the point that the next opportunity, they don't want to say no to me. Mm-hmm. And the next opportunity was Chelsea. And I ended up having a really great 4 years there. I was a writer for three of those, on the round table for four.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to be in LA, which I really love. I'm not really a New York gal. I like the city, but I just don't know that I would have thrived there. And I got to do all these, you know, I got to really hone in on my acting more.
Yeah.
As a result. And I've been working steady ever since. Yeah. Chelsea.
Coming up, Fortune and I talk about the time I got to see her play Ann Coulter live when the right-wing firebrand canceled on Chelsea Handler at the last minute. I love the some of the characters that you played on the most recent, the Chelsea's Netflix show, which this is kind of funny, but the show that she did that was supposed to have Ann Coulter as a guest,
yeah. Uh-huh.
I was there in audience because
how funny.
I was there to cover it because,
right.
Of course,
yeah,
my editor said,
word got out,
Ann Coulter's going to be on the show.
Yeah.
You should go see what happens, because it was I think it would have been pretty exciting stuff.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Instead, she canceled at the last minute, and you appeared as, I believe, Ann Coulter's body double was how you were introduced.
I think she said I was Ann Coulter.
I'd love to talk about your thoughts on women's, like, reproductive rights or voting, women's rights to vote.
Yeah, I would love to talk to you about women. Hold on. These are my thoughts on women. I like to write down what I have to say about women. It would be a much better country if women did not vote. That is simply a fact. You heard me. Yeah. Oh, deal with it.
And I think it would have been an interesting conversation between the two. I wish that she had not canceled.
But it was pretty fun what you guys ended up pulling off.
Well,
anyway,
I was like, I don't even remember. I was like at a Starbucks and Chelsea texted me like, hey, she didn't tell me what. She goes, someone canceled. Can you be here in like an hour? And I'm like, what? Okay. And I happened to not be working that day because I was doing Mindy Project, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And I got down there because she loved to put me in outfits.
Mm-hmm. You played Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Yeah,
played Ivanka Trump. You got all the all the political.
People, I don't look like any of these people, and I'm much larger than all of them. But she just thinks it's hilarious to have me be whoever and try to own it. So she's like, you're going to play Ann Coulter. And I'm like, what? She goes, but that's the funny part. That was kind of the, you know, to be like, all right, well, then this is who's going to play you if you're not going to be here.
Yeah.
So I just went out there in a wig. I think I was still in my jeans and t-shirt. And I read from her crazy book.
Yeah.
And then that led to then doing Ivanka. And then that led to Sarah Huckabee, which that one really resonated with people because of the accent. My accent was very similar to hers. And I played her. We were kind of the first people that did the impressions of Sarah. Mm-hmm. Then SNL started a little bit after that. But I played her very intense.
Mm-hmm.
SNL played her you know, the like, what's happening?
Yeah.
I played her more of a, you know, very like, I would try to put Chelsea in her place.
Yeah.
So that was fine. It was fun while it lasted because at the time things were a little lighter. Mm-hmm. And then as Sarah kind of became more complicit in the falsities, whatever you want to call it, whatever the word is.
Lies. Yeah.
Lies. That it became a little more difficult for me.
Yeah.
And I am not a political comedian. Mm-hmm. I don't like to get political.
Yeah.
So for me, that was an uncomfortable. I would do it for. I did it for Chelsea for the fun of it.
Yeah.
But then once it became more than just the fun thing, that was hard for me.
Did you get any odd feedback or, you know?
I did at the very last thing we shot was something that they wrote. Again, I'm so used on Chelsea lately to just being like, hey, you're going to do this thing. You don't know what's written. Mm-hmm. You just put on a wig and do the thing. They were like, you're going to, you know, come do this one last tutorial, this makeup thing. They wrote it. I didn't read it. And it focused more on the physical appearance of things. And
this was Sarah Huckabee.
Yeah. And people didn't like it. I mean, some people loved it, but many people were like, oh, you're now making fun of someone's appearance, which I'm not a fan of doing. Mm-hmm. But you just kind of, you're like, they asked me to do this character. Yeah. I play this character. I got to do what's written.
Yeah.
And I got like 4 days of hate mail oof. And like death threats.
Oh, geez.
And then you go, this isn't fun.
Yeah.
Like why? But it coincided with the end of the show. So it was coming to an end naturally anyway.
Yeah. So you were kind of like, okay, this time is not ending.
That's not who I am. And it's not, you know, it's.
You didn't want to be like, that's what you were known for.
No. Or, yeah. And I even got asked to play that. I got asked to play her at several different like conventions and other things, and I said no.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, that's not what I'm trying to put out in the world. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, was doing a silly, to me, character, even though it was based on a real person, for Chelsea in a fun thing, and then, you know, then you move on to the next thing.
Well, you've done lots of great stuff since then. I want to kind of go through, as we're getting towards the end, some of your other credits that you've had over the last few years, and just if there's a story or memory that pops out, we can talk about it. So I think what the thing that probably most people know you from at this point is the Mindy Project, where you had a major role for several seasons.
Yeah.
So what was that experience like for you?
That experience was awesome. That's where I finally got to sort of prove myself as an actor. And it was the first thing I got to do that was beyond just a couple spots here and there. And what had happened is I had sold my own sitcom with Tina Fey and Robert Carlock to ABC. We shot that pilot, and it was like my baby.
Was based on your life.
Based on my life. It was called Family Fortune. It was such an amazing experience from start to finish. And Annie Potts played my mom. I played me. John Carroll Lynch was my dad. It was like a stellar group of people. And it didn't go. You know, you film these things and it went well. The show was funny, but it just didn't go. Mm-hmm. And you don't ever really know why. And but part of that experience was it was a bunch of 30 Rock writers came to. They all help each other out.
Yeah.
And they came because I co-wrote it with Matt Hubbard, who was a 30 Rock writer. And so they did a bunch of punch-ups. And one of the writers, Lang Fisher, wrote on the Mindy Project now. And she said to Mindy, like, you gotta, you know, there was a guest star role. She's like, hey, you should check out this girl, Fortune. She just did this pilot. She's really funny. So, again, this huge no that really broke my heart opened this other door that I never would have. I might not have gotten that opportunity otherwise. So she ended up hiring me for a 3-episode guest star. That led to a 9-episode guest star that then led to 3 seasons as a series regular. Yeah. So it was
awesome. Wild. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Another comedy dream is you were a voice on The Simpsons.
Yeah, that was really
cool. What was that
cool.
like?
I mean, that really was a dream come true. A dream that I didn't even know. You don't even know you have because you think there's no way I'm ever going to get to be a voice on The Simpsons. I've been doing, Bless the Hearts. It's a new animated show on Fox, and it's the same, casting, director, and they have this character coming up who's Southern, and he suggested them to them, for me to do it. And so I had a call with the writer of the episode, and you know, I was just thinking that he was going to tell me some information about the character, and then that I would have to somehow audition for him either on the phone or come in. And he's like, all right, great. Well, we're excited. And I go, what? Like, I just get to do this. And yeah, they were so nice. And you know, you go in that booth and it's just like you, it's so, they're so casual about it.
Cause they've been doing it. They've been doing it for 30 something years.
Yeah. 30 years. And you're just like, oh my God, your mind's blown at every corner. And, yeah, they give you a big box of Simpsons swag. And then the cool part about this character that I got to play was that I play Patty's first girlfriend.
Because
Patty did technically date someone, but they ended up being a man. So I am technically the first girlfriend. And so that was a big deal, Patty being Marge's sister.
Bringing it back to representation.
Yes, exactly. And then I basically play a female Homer. And the joke is that, you know, Patty hates Homer. And now she's dating Homer. And so when they were like, you're kind of the female Homer, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Which I know they've had, I think they had a similar, like a character kind of be that sort of type at some point, but just to get to be like,
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
You also follow the pro cornhole tour?
Sure do. I used to play on my daddy's farm. We'd toss bags all day, even when it was hotter than a $2 pistol.
That is hot. Do you always speak in such colorful southernisms?
Does a mama possum skip church on Sundays?
So this is how we're going to end. I'm going to ask, this is a question I ask all the guests. Who's the person that you've worked with that makes you laugh the hardest?
Oh, man. Oh, God. I've worked, I'll tell you two different people because they've been in two different situations. Well, I'll say Ike Barinholtz on Mindy Project could always make me belly laugh. He has so many stories, and he's always like commanding a room full of his tales and crazy stories. At Chelsea Lately, the writer's room as a whole, it was like Jen Kirkman, Sarah Colonna, Heather McDonald, Chris Frangiola. We belly laughed every day. Like a laugh, I don't think I've experienced those kind of consistent, like, hearty, laughs in my entire life. And it was, you know, every job is stressful, but that sort of thing was so special. And we could cry, laugh every day. And no one person sort of, you know, stood out. It was everyone jumping on each other's bits,
It's like the collective mind does it,
Yeah.
Is there any, you know, day or moment from that writer's room that you can remember right now when you think back to it?
I mean, nothing specific because, you know, I did like 500 shows, you know.
It's a blur.
Such a blur. But it's more of a feeling of just like, I'll never have an experience like that again, and I'll never laugh harder and have such camaraderie with people. Because when you're with somebody all day, every day, and you're making, they made 1,000 shows. I was half of the 500 or 600 or something. You just are like, this is so special.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like, I'm like, I don't think I'll ever be on a writing staff like that, you know, because now my goals are a little different. I'm trying to do more on camera stuff. So I'm glad I got to experience what that was like, making a show, and just fans were paying attention, but like the industry wasn't. So we got to do whatever we wanted. Most of it good, some of it bad.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, oh my God, like, what were we thinking? And then, but at the end of the day, you're like just trying to make people laugh, and then your goals change. And you're like, okay, now, you know, this was a really amazing thing I got to, fun thing I got to do. Now I want to sort of pivot into the more acting stand up stuff.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming in, and congrats on the special.
Of course. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it. Yeah. I hope people watch January 21st.
Yeah.
Today. Sweet and Salty, it's called.
Yeah. On Netflix.
Yeah.
Check it out. All right.
All right. Bye.
Thanks again to Fortune Feimster for being my guest on this week's show. I just love how laid back and easy to talk to she is. Fortune's new stand-up special, Sweet and Salty, is streaming now on Netflix. Definitely check that out if you haven't already. If you like this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're really into this podcast thing, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!